When we talk about business nowadays, of course, the world has changed, and the world has changed significantly in what we value. If anybody reads the business news any given week, for sure, there are clear cases where the value of making something and selling something is not worth nearly as much as the value of ideas. The most valuable companies that we look at, the FANG companies, the Facebooks, the Googles, basically sell nothing, but they have intellectual property, they have ideas, they have algorithms, they have copyrights, they have patents that really in today's world are valued much more than items themselves. In last week's news, if you watch Tesla is now worth more than Ford, more than General Motors, more than Toyota, all combined. And the idea being, of course, it's not that they're ever going to make that much money. It's unclear if it's really worth that much. But the thought is that the technology that they have, the patents that they have, that which they don't own physically, is really where value is nowadays. And it's interesting because these are items that come up in the Beis Din. Every so often, we will have a case where a patent is involved or something of the like. And the question becomes, to what extent do we recognize intellectual property in halacha? Think about it. At the time of the Rishonim, for example, there was no way a person could make money on intellectual property. If I wrote a song, a beautiful song, there was no way to make money on it other than if someone would pay me to sing the song. And if they were paying me to sing the song, they were paying me for my voice. They weren't paying me for the song itself. There's no way I could stop someone else from singing the song. There's no way I could stop someone performing the song. Up until the point where we have the technology, where you could take the song and make it something physically, to make it into a CD, to make it into an MP3, to an 8-track, whatever you're going to make it into, there was really nothing to talk about in terms of intellectual property. So you have something called intellectual property, which did not exist at the time of the Gemara, at the time of the Rishonim. And now we turn to a point in history where the worth of this intellectual property is much greater than items themselves. So the question becomes, is there anything in the halacha which could apply to this amorphous idea of intellectual property? In general, when we talk about ownership, we talk about kinyanim. We talk about hagbah, we talk about mashicha. I pick up something, I grab something. This is amorphous. There's nothing to grab. There's nothing to own. And therefore, halachically, can we have such a concept as intellectual property? One of the more interesting approaches to this was from a former Rosh Yeshiva from YU, Rav Shimon Shkop, known for other things as well. Rav Shimon Shkop, in his first piece on Bava Kama, raises an interesting question. We know in Bava Kama, we talk about the Arba Avos Nezikin, the forms of torts that are out there, and one of the forms of torts are bor. If I dig a hole in Rosh HaRabim in a public place, and somebody drives by, falls in, etc., I am liable. And the question becomes, why should I be liable? I don't own this pit. Right? I don't own the public area it was built in. I can't charge rent in it. If there's rain, I don't own what goes into the pit. So since it is not my pit, why, again, we understand logically why, but halachically, how can you explain why a person should be liable for what happened? Rav Shimon Shkop explains that when I make something, it becomes mine. Right? That even though I technically don't own the real estate, I don't own what's in the pit, but that the fact that this flat road has become a pit, that in fact is something that is mine. And based on the idea in the negative, I can just use my outdoors voice. And based on the fact that in the negative I would be obligated, I would be liable for what I did, so too the flip side would be true as well. In the positive, if I created something, just like I'm liable for what that creation does, so too the opposite end would be that I am entitled to the value of that which was made. So therefore, Rav Shimon Shkop gives a
way of perhaps understanding this concept of intellectual property. Now, that's very original, but that's a major jump forward. One is you have to assume that is the reason why a person is obligated, liable for a bore. And two, you also have to be able to turn around into the positive. Not saying it's wrong, but I'm saying that's a major jump. If you look at the Shaul Hamashiv of Yosef Shaul Nathanson, lived in the 19th century. So in the 19th century, we already have printing presses. We have printing presses that are common. And therefore, we have the first major cases of intellectual property, that being in Svarim. Again, at this point, somebody has ideas. The ideas can be put down in a physical form in a book. And the question is whether once I put my ideas in the book, whether someone could use those ideas, someone could reprint the book, could reprint parts of the book, etc. Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson in the Shaul Hamashiv thinks that there is definitely something called intellectual property. And he explains it based on several ideas. And the major idea that he uses, he thinks that this is a case of law that the world understands. He gives an interesting case. I was looking it up a little bit, that in Poland, there were several computing machines that were created. Some of the earliest computers were created in the 19th century in Poland, and they were all created by Jews, and they have very Jewish names. And he points out that anyone who created one of these machines was given money by the government, that they in fact recognized that the person had rights to what they did. And of course, halacha could not be less than secular law. Now, the problem which he alludes to and he realizes is that halacha had a way of dealing with intellectual property for years beforehand. And that was before somebody would publish a sefer, that person would go to the local Beis Din, and the local Beis Din would give it exclusivity for a certain amount of time. That the local Beis Din would say, you know, for the next 3 years, 5 years, this person put down a lot of money, a lot of startup costs in order to publish a shas. If somebody competes right away, it would be terrible. So therefore, for the next 6 months, for the next year, 3 years, 5 years, nobody is allowed to publish a shas like this and sell it. Or they would put it a different way, that this person's first run is 300 copies. Until the first run is sold out, no one else is allowed to sell. Now the question is obvious. The question is, if there is something called intellectual property, why is it necessary for the Beis Din to grant exclusivity for a certain amount of time? After all, shouldn't halacha naturally give the person exclusivity forever for what they do? If they own their intellectual property, it's theirs. There's nothing that has to be granted beyond that. So the Shaul Hamashiv has a very interesting approach, and he says as follows. He says, truth be told, somebody who publishes an original sefer, in fact, does have exclusivity forever. However, he said, when somebody writes a sefer, it's not just a matter of making money, but a lot of people want their ideas to get out into the world, right? There are so many examples, there's so many websites that we have now, HebrewBooks.org, Safaria, etc., where authors allow their svarim to be republished for free, to be put online for free, because at the end of the day, thank God they're not making their money this way. This is not how they're making their living. And what they really want is that people should grow and learn from their ideas. To the extent that somebody learns from the sefer, and there is some schar, there is some reward to be had, more people the better. He said, so therefore what's actually happening in these cases is it's not a matter of saying that really the author had no rights, but now the Beis Din is extending the rights for a certain amount of time. No, it's quite the opposite. He's saying that, truth be told, the author has unlimited rights, and the author is turning around and saying, once I break even, once I make a minimal amount of profit, at that point I give people the right to take whatever they want. It's a very interesting idea, and an idea that the Beis Yitzchak thinks is absolutely wrong. Because were it to be true that a person really had the rights and was now giving it away, why do I have to go to a Beis Din to give it away? I myself could write in the opening page of the sefer, this is my sefer, and I hereby announce I don't need anyone to agree to me to give away my rights. So the fact that they have to go to a Beis Din would indicate quite the opposite. It would indicate that, in fact, they are getting rights. And the fact that they have to get rights indicates that there is nothing halachically called intellectual property. And in fact, that is the opinion of the Beis Yitzchak. And he says that at the end of the day, halacha does not provide for intellectual property. However, on the other hand, he says that even though halacha does not provide for that, there is still something called dina de malchus adina. That within halacha, we accept in certain cases that the law of the land is binding upon us as well. And it's an interesting question when that is true. But for an example, where Moshe Feinstein says clearly that bankruptcy is something that applies even in a Beis Din. So if I borrow $100,000, I get bankruptcy protection, and then the next day I win the lottery, so under secular law, I don't have to pay the rest of my debt. However, what about if someone took me to Beis Din and said, a debt's a debt? So Moshe says, no, there's something called intellectual, there's something called Dina de Malchus Adina, and under the rules of Dina de Malchus Adina, even in Beis Din, the debt has been retired and I cannot collect it. So to here, the Beis Yitzchak is very clear in saying that at the end of the day, what's happening here as well is that no intellectual property does not exist straight out of halacha, but Dina de Malchus Adina is applicable here, and therefore copyrights, trademarks, patents, to the extent that, in our case, the U.S. government gives rights, those governments are enforceable in a Beis Din, and they are halachically true as well. That is one approach as to where intellectual property comes from. There are other interesting approaches as well. I'll mention them quickly as our time is somewhat limited. Another approach, which is given by the Chasam Sofer, which is very interesting, says as follows, that there has to be something called intellectual property, because if people did not have rights to what they wrote, nobody would write. I remember years ago, the Jewish music industry got up and said, if people don't stop copying their music, Jewish music industry is going to go out of business. Would that be a good thing, a bad thing? It's not for me to decide. But at the end of the day, if people would stop printing Sfarim, that would be problematic. Right? That we believe that there is great value to people that are doing work on old Sfarim, reprinting and footnoting them, writing new Sfarim. This is something that we intellectually, halachically very much want. And the Chasam Sofer argues that if, as soon as I write a Sefer, right, if I'm going to write a Sefer, it's going to cost me a lot of money to publish. In the event that nobody's interested in the Sefer, I'm going to lose my money. In the event somebody's interested in the Sefer, someone else is going to publish it, and I'll be lucky to break even. So therefore, no one's going to get involved anymore. So therefore, the Chasam Sofer says, practically, there has to be something called intellectual property, because if there was no intellectual property, we would not have people doing the necessary work in these cases. It's interesting that the Parashas Mordechai writes the exact opposite. He says that economically that's not true. It's the reminiscent of the old Groucho Marx line. Well, actually, I think it was a Yogi Berra line. The place is so crowded no one goes there anymore. Right? So it'd be the same idea that the problem that if you turn around and say, you know, what's going to happen here? No one's going to write Svarim because everyone's going to be copying the Svarim. It doesn't really make sense. The opposite's going to be true. At the end of the day, in the event that we give a natural monopoly to anybody who produces anything, the prices are going to be ridiculous. Right? If you ever look at what academic books cost, $150 a book, $200 a book, because they know that there's a minimal amount of people that are going to buy it, and this is what they'll pay. But at the end of the day, most of the books are just not accessible to the Hamon Am. Mm-hmm. So too, if we gave automatic monopolies, if we gave intellectual property over to the people who are writing and publishing the Sfarim, they're going to raise the prices to such a level that it will not be accessible to everybody. So he says, in fact, if you want to make sure that the most Sfarim are published, the idea is not to give a monopoly. It's an interesting economic question. I was an economics major here. And I think the answer happens to be as follows. I happen to think that the Chasam Sofer and the Parashas Mordechai are both right. In the event that you have intellectual property, you will have more Svarim published, but less copies of each Sefer because of the price involved. In the event that you don't have it, there'll be less of a variety of Svarim that are put out, but more people will have them in their home libraries because they will be more accessible in terms of price. So that's the general issues as to whether or not one is right or the other one. But a second approach definitely is this idea that in order for us to maximize the amount of Svarim that we have, it is important that we somehow keep the prices reasonable, and on the other hand, make sure that the people that are producing it are also making a living as they do it. The Ramah, there's a famous story that in the times of the Ramah, the Maharal Mipadu came out with a new version of the Rambam. And obviously, in those days, even more so than these days, the startup costs were very great. And since the startup costs were very great, there was a certain amount of time that was given in order that there be exclusivity. And then what happened was, in order to raise the money to make this possible, there were investors that came in. And among the investors that came in was a non-Jewish investor. And there was another non-Jewish investor who wanted to get in, but sorry, it was closed. And this second investor was very upset. And therefore, he published his own Rambam and charged one gold coin less. Same Rambam, same everything, just cheaper. And the question was there a way to stop this other person from selling? And to the extent that that person could be stopped from selling, probably not, can you perhaps turn around and stop the other people from buying? So the Ramah gets involved as to what are the rights in this case, and among the arguments he makes is that this would fall under the what we call in modern day talk, Hasagas Gvul. That once one person has a business, you cannot butt in on their business, that this would be a case of unfair competition. So even though the Ramah is of the opinion that this is a case of unfair competition, the truth of the matter would be that we don't necessarily follow that in all cases. That assuming that my startup costs and your startup costs are similar, it is unclear that this would be a case of unfair competition. So that is another approach that is taken. So the bottom line is there are many concerns that come in, but there's nothing clearly that we could put the case of Hasagas Gvul into. Another example, if you look at the Mishnah in Avos, we talk about Purim is not that far away. So ultimately, the beginning of the happy ending of the Purim story, okay, is that when one night Achashverosh, maybe not, so is that when Achashverosh can't sleep at night, and he is reminded of the great acts that Mordechai. I remember a few years ago, Chief Rabbi at the time, Sachs, spoke here in YU, and he was having this issue. And he said he was speaking at one point in some large area, and a woman in back yelled out, "Can't hear ya!" So the guy in front turned and yelled, said, "I can. Do you want to switch seats?" So take advantage if you like. I'll use my outdoor voice. There's some seats available in front if you're interested. There's some seats in the back if you're interested. Choose wisely. So, if you remember, as Esther, the turn for the positive is that Achashverosh can't sleep at night. He should read him a story. They take out the storybook and they read him the story about Bigson Viseresh. And in this story, he finds out that his life was saved. And he asks, who did it? And the answer was Mordechai. And because of that, Kacha Yeser Ish, the whole story turns around. How did he know Mordechai? Who actually reported the story? It was Esther. It was Esther who did it. But Esther did it not by saying, "I am aware." But she said it in the name of Mordechai.
And based on that, we know from this story that if somebody says something, b'shem omro, if someone doesn't plagiarize, but rather they say something and they give credit where credit is due, that's maybe ge'ula la'olam, that in fact helps us save the entire world. It brings great redemption to us. So that would be another indication that a person cannot take advantage, cannot just go republish someone else's writings without, of course, at least noting that the person did it, that the person has certain rights to it. If someone tells me an idea that I'd like to share, it's important that I footnote it, that I note that this is where it came from. Again, that indicates that the person who came up with this idea has a certain amount of bialis, has a certain amount of ownership over their ideas. Let's skip ahead with the time that's left to the modern day poskim to see where we are. So if you want to look inside, I haven't been very good at following the sheet at all. So let's assume we're up to number 14. So Rav Avadia Yosef Maran says, Oda she'ra so im yesh din yerusha rabbanim asher aviyim chibeh chibur b'divrei Torah. This is the question of a person writes svarim that are never published, that person passes away, and the question is now, who owns the svarim? Is this intellectual property, can it pass down in Yerusha? Is this part of the estate that a person leaves behind? Can they turn around and say, no one can publish it without our permission? Or do we say, no, that Moshe Rabbeinu was told that just like he gave over the Torah, would not receive payment for that, so too, Torah is not owned by anybody. That is the question. So Rav Avadia says, so Ladina, bottom line, Pashad Amin Aso Hain Medina de Machusa, Hain Apia Gezeros Vascomus Machabim Varabanda Maskima Chiburim. He said the bottom line is intellectual property nowadays is owned by, in this case, the author. Why? So he kind of says, well, either it's because that rights are given over by the Beis Din, or because of Dina de Machusa, that each country provides for intellectual property. And therefore, we follow those rules. Now, that's important. That's an important difference. Because, as we said, if I own my intellectual property like I own my physical property, then, of course, I own it totally, wholly, forever. In the event that my ownership is limited to what the government gives me, so intellectual property does not last forever. So to give you an example here, in the next paragraph, we talk about copyright protection lasts for 70 years after the death of the author. If the work was a work for hire, then copyright persists for 120 years after creation or 95 years after publication, whichever is shorter. For works created before 1978, copyright durations are complicated, etc., etc. However, works created before 1924 have made their way into the public domain. So the bottom line is anything nowadays, this was written a few years ago, but anything that's been around for over 90 years, at this point there is no copyright. So let's take, for example, a sefer like the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan was published in the 19-teens. Nowadays, if I would like to publish a copy of the Aruch HaShulchan, even if there are people that are descendants of the Aruch HaShulchan, the argument is that to the extent that there is something called intellectual property, if the intellectual property is limited only to the Dina de Malchusa intellectual property, then there's no stopping me. Because at this point, the property rights have expired. If you tell me that halachically there are rights unto themselves, then of course I would be limited, I would not be allowed to do it. In terms of more recent poskim, there seems to be a disagreement between Rav Yashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Skipping to 16, we have here a few questions that were offered to the two Gedolim in their time. It's interesting, you can get an idea when this sefer was written, because it's written to Rav Yashiv Shlita and Rav Shlomo Zalman Zatzal. You get an idea. Unfortunately, they both have the same last name now. And the question is as follows. Hayotzer Yitzira Im Yeshro Balas Ala Yitzira. Uma Makar Lezeh. When somebody creates something, do you own it? And if so, where do we see that ownership is transferred? So first he says, logically, I did the work, I created it, it should be mine. I am a tshuva shol lemeshiv, because it will be bircha shlomo, v'chein apagei b'zachusa over al gezel dal raisa. So it's clear that Rabbi Yashiv follows the opinion of the shol lemeshiv, and he says that there is something naturally called intellectual property, and because that exists, even without any laws of the country, I created it, I own it, I own it forever, and therefore there is no limitation of the Dina de Malchusa that is brought down by the U.S. government. That might give you additional rights, but it's not a limitation. Similarly, Im Yesh Chus Yotzei Malchus, what about audio? Do I own that? Lo Kizeh Dovash Ein Bo Mamash. He said, that's different. That there's, if I write something, that exists. Sound does not exist. Rak Mikoach HaMalchus VaMinog. However, he says, in that case, when it comes to a recording, since there is Dina de Malchusa, since in our case, the U.S. government gives certain copyrights to sounds, to recordings, therefore, that is the limitation. So again, when it comes to the written work, Rav Eliyashiv says, you have unlimited ownership, just like if it was physical. When it comes to the spoken word, it is limited by the rules of copyright. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach did not agree. So they asked the same question, Ma Makor Issa HaFaros Zechuyos Yotze, where does it come from? He says, HaIssu Midin HaSagas Gvor V'Yorigu Nosso Shal Chaveiro. He says, the problem there is you're taking away someone else's parnasa. Now, of course, that is much more limited, right? Meaning that if nobody is selling this right now, or I'm just sharing it with someone who would have never bought it anyhow, or the like, one can make a strong argument that there is no problem here. Then he goes on, can I copy a few lines for something that says on it, copyrighted? So the bottom line is everyone does it. He said, technically he doesn't think there's a problem, but in terms of what is the proper action, the Musar approach is, the person worked very hard, if he doesn't want you to do it, don't do it. Finally, they asked him, then what about the Sholem Meshiv? He says, so he's very clear that he disagrees with Rav Eliyashiv and says that the bottom line is we do not follow the opinion of the Sholem Meshiv. We don't think that there is in fact something called intellectual property. So according to Rav Shlomo Zalman, yes, there is intellectual property, but the intellectual property is limited to the secular law, the Din of Malchusa intellectual property. In sum, this is a matter of dispute. It's an important question. At a bare minimum, though, there is agreement that whatever the law is, that is also the halacha, and it would be upheld in Beis Din. Thank you.